Hello and welcome to The Week at Work. I'm your host, David Gibney, this week. I'm joined by my co-hosts, Michelle Byrne and Connor McCabe. As always, The Week at Work is part of the Left Block Project. If you want to know more about us or you want to put your hand in your pocket and give a bit of support to any of the podcasts, including this one associated with Left Block, you can go to patreon.com/Left Block. As always, we're going to go to one of our guests or one of our co-hosts to talk about the news of the week. I'll go to you, Michelle, first. What story caught your eye this morning?
Well, there was a few, Dave. I was reading the Sunday Business Post this morning, and on the front page, it talks about how taxpayers are losing as insurers keep millions in state funds cut from COVID payouts. So essentially, the government had kind of said, you know, we're going to pursue any businesses or insurance firms that have been claiming COVID payments, like, and that they shouldn't have been. But now, of course, they said, the law says we can't do that now. We have to let them keep all of those state supports that we gave them. But it's just an interesting one because, like, reading the across the papers, there's different stories. How it talks about, you know, so this is effectively subsidizing the insurance industry. But on another page, I was reading how, you know, we have to recoup the money that the parents paid the babysitters through the state support scheme. So a number of parents were paying their child minders via state supports. Like, you know, considering that, like, they are working for them and they are losing out on work if they can't use their child minder due to, like, you know, harsh lockdowns. But no, they said the parents have to recoup the costs that they paid to the child minders, but the insurance companies or the businesses, nah, they couldn't possibly recoup them because, you know, the law says something or other that businesses, for whatever reason, can't retrospectively recoup costs. But if you're a domestic worker, we'll take that money back off you, no bothers. It's this whole thing of, like, so if you're making profits, we can't recoup, but if it's just you're paying for workers in a domestic situation, it just seems, again, it's that conflicting information of, like, one rule for some and one for the other. So, like, you know, you can subsidize businesses, but you can't subsidize like workers, basically, is what I'm hearing from this story.
Yeah, I made the exact same connection as you, actually, the linkage of the two stories, which are separated by about 6 or 7 pages. So it seems we're on the same wavelength there. But yeah, the taxpayers lose as insurers keep millions in state funds cut from COVID payout stories. The whole angle of it is you can't do it retrospectively. We can't reclaim the money retrospectively, but they don't need to do that. The government are the government, you know, they govern. What they could do is bring in a levy on a company that has availed of those state subsidies over the last 12 months. But look, we spoke about this a couple of weeks ago, didn't we? I think about how we were all supportive of how quickly the state moved on bringing in the temporary wage subsidy scheme because it needed to protect jobs and all the rest of it. But because of that speed, there were going to be errors in it. Sure, they can fix those errors if they wanted to. And look, we know if the state had an appetite to pursue this, they would. They don't, because this is, as you say, about profits versus child minders.
I think it highlights the thing, and look, it always comes back to this, like the absolute irony of, like, private insurance companies not being able to claim state supports in order to do insurance payouts. But, like, the whole point of insurance is that when we need insurance, that like you pay into insurance so you can pay out when you need it. But, like, it kind of goes back to that whole point of how we need a state insurance company. Like, why are we paying a private company to, like, state supports in order for them to pay out the insurance claims that they need? Oh, it's just, it's just bizarre, like, how this is allowed to happen.
Yeah, it's frustrating, all right. And yeah, symbolic of the Irish state, though. So, Connor, I don't know, have you got any other stories there you wanted to talk about?
Yeah, I mean, I picked up the Sunday Independent, and they have a poll on the front page, which is always a sign of a slogan in news day. LDK's a poll, and they're really trying to spin, like, Sinn Féin is on like 33%. And they're really, and Fine Gael are on 23%, you know, and Buckingham Fall are on 19%, and there's no movement for the other kind of small kind of parties. And they're really trying to spin that, like, you know, this is not a vote for change or a vote for, like, Sinn Féin. They're which is a bit mad. But like, you know, there's a piece here from what's his name, Jody Corcoran, who I thought, like, there's a name from the past. I thought he was well gone, but he's still kind of hanging around. And he's saying that voters prefer current kind of coalition over Sinn Féin led alternative, which is just nonsense. Like, one of the questions Bishley asked was, in a forced choice, if someone put a gun to your head, which of the following would be your preferred kind of government? And 38% said Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil, Green, which is roughly what the parties are getting anyway. It's actually less than what the parties are getting.
How does that work?
Yeah, there are the people voting for Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil, and Greens go, oh, I don't want to see them in the government, though, you know.
That's the Green voter who didn't want to be in with the coalition there.
I know, yeah, yeah. It's when Lorna Brogan is. But like, and then a Sinn Féin-led government with Greens, Labour, Sock Dems and others on the left, it would be 24%. So because that's lower than the 28%, they say, that just shows that people aren't voting for a left-led government. It's neck and neck, and it's just outside the margin of error. And the other point is that we don't have a first-past-the-post British system. So this is PR. So, I mean, you know, it's not about percentages. It's about can you translate them into votes or into seats in multiple constituencies. What is interesting is that well outside the margin of error is the option for a Sinn Féin Fianna Fáil government, and that's 10%.
Right.
Which shows that, like, not even, like, at best, one-third of, like, Sinn Féin voters would be in favour of that. And that's at best, you know. Like, it's not an option for those who are voting for the parties. I don't think that'll make any difference. If a Sinn Féin, like Fianna Fáil government, is the option on table, Sinn Féin are not waiting 5 years. They're going in the government, and it's just with whoever will go in kind of with them. So if it's Fianna Fáil, these polls kind of don't matter. They will go into government. And then the least kind of favourable one is a Sinn Féin Fine Gael government, which is at 3%. So I did the maths, and that's around 105,000 voters. So there's over 100,000 people out there who we were walking around with, you know, bumping into in, like, supermarkets and on buses, who actually think that a Sinn Féin Fine Gael government is a good option. It's 100,000 of them.
Yeah. So,
like, this is a mad country. And then a 16% who are just not sure. So, like, it's like, really, it's a treading water type poll. There's no real change. Sinn Féin are still by far in the largest kind of single party. But there is still an option there for Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil, Labour, you know, kind of Sock Dems, who knows.
Mm.
Like, government. It's still a play. What's key is that who will lead the next kind of, like, coalition? Will it be a Fine Gael led one, or will it be a Sinn Féin, a Sinn Féin led one? At the moment, and this can change, but at the moment, that seems to be where kind of Irish politics is at the moment.
Yeah. It's interesting that Sinn Féin have maintained their status as the top party for so long now. I know there's people out there who probably expected them to drop as a result of, you know, as time went on, that thought this was a temporary bounce. Mm. And as the government moved through the pandemic and all the rest of it and made decisions, that Sinn Féin would drop in popularity and Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil would increase. But
Well, actually, you know, it's a good point, because it's something that, like, Kevin Conor Cunningham, who's the head of the Garland Things, who did the poll, he has a pretty good kind of article based on this. And like usually I'm very kind of wary or skeptic of, like, of kind of posters, but they do print, they made a point of printing their kind of methodology, and it is quite kind of, it's quite robust, you know. So, like, they've obviously kind of done their work on this. What he says is that And I'm sure that Sinn Féin kind of, you know, members will able to think otherwise. But I do think there's an element of truth in this. He says that it's their feeling from the answers that are coming back. It's more of an anti-government Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael vote rather than a pro-Conan Sinn Féin. Mm. It's a mixture of both, obviously. You know, like Mary Lou, Piers Doherty, Owen O'Brien, these are popular kind of politicians. But there is still an element of it's an anti-government, anti-Fianna Fáil, anti-Fine Gael kind of vote. And Sinn Féin, as what kind of opposition parties should do, they have consolidated their kind of vote around that kind of opposition, which is what kind of opposition parties should do. So what's happened is that as the Fine Gael kind of Fianna Fáil share but got the vote, that has dropped about kind of 10%. It's gone from around 52% to around 40% now. So that's a big change. Mm-hmm. That like those other kind of myriad of voices, they have voters seem to have consolidated their anti-government vote into kind of Sinn Féin because the Sock Dems, Labour and Solidarity are not picking up elect support in the polls. And again, like no opinion poll survives contact with reality. Once an election is called, those kind of 3 months, things can change.
Mm.
Like in mid 2019, Sinn Féin got 11% of the vote in the local elections, lost half of their councillors. And 6 months later, 8 months later, they double, like almost double their number of like TDs.
Yeah.
So I mean, things can change.
And that election, it changed in the last week.
It did. Yeah. It was massive. It was the first time ever where like Sinn Féin's vote went up during the like campaign, you know?
Yeah.
But like normally they peaked and then they went down, you know?
And interestingly, on that one, in that election, and you think they'd have learned from this, but the more they attacked Sinn Féin, both the mainstream media, but also the political parties, the more of a bounce Sinn Féin got. And we saw it during the week there. I don't know if you guys saw it, but there was an attack from a Labour Party TD, Jed Nash, over the way Mary Lou McDonald referenced the public sector, saying that it's, what was the word, constipated. Mary Lou McDonald said there's good people working in the public and civil service, but the system itself is constipated. And of course, Labour came out and attacked that and said that they were attacking public sector workers. Now, this is obviously coming from the party who brought in Fempi and all of the other attacks on the public sector over the period of time that they were in government. But I found it interesting that still they haven't learned that they're going after Sinn Féin and they're actually, I believe it's helping Sinn Féin by these little attacks.
Yeah, again, like going back to kind of Kevin Cunningham's kind of article, which is quite, it's like he's obviously kind of thought about it. There's a couple of points in that he makes around kind of populism that I wouldn't agree with. And I think that he's wrong there. But he does make a point about why attacking Sinn Féin won't make any difference. Just what you said there, and he said that for the most part, from what they can see, the rise in the Sinn Féin vote, because it's an anti-government vote, it doesn't matter if you attack on Sinn Féin, because it's not about Sinn Féin, it's about Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, you know. And like 17% only, the support for like Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael combined, there among kind of renters is at 17%. You know, now who are these 17% of renters out there who are voting for Fianna Fáil and like Fine Gael, and like, can we get their names, please? Because I mean, like, who in bejesus, who's a renter, is voting for Fine Gael and the Fianna Fáil kind of policy? 17% would, you know. So, anyway, but like, yes, yeah, so he's kind of saying to them in a very kind of gentle way, he's not speaking to us, he's not speaking to the left, he's speaking to the right here. And he's more or less kind of gently kind of saying to them, lads, stop talking about it like the army councils, stop talking about, like, in the Sindo, there's an entire article on the IRA's Green Book right? It was their kind of their in-house kind of manual, their in-house training kind of manual from the HR kind of department. And you know, and he was talking about, you know, how the IRA would do X, Y, and Z. And like when I'm saying, that doesn't matter. People don't care. Mm. This isn't why people are voting for Sinn Féin or not voting for Sinn Féin. This is about housing. It's about health. It's about cost of living. It's about kind of tackling kind of these things. And until you do that, then you won't actually get anywhere. I might go back to that because, I mean, I think that that idea of, like, why don't Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael tackle housing kind of properly? It seems to be a, like, no-brainer. We might go back to, because there's a short article on, like, NAMA, but I have been ranting on for about 10 minutes now.
No, it's all good. We will come back to it, definitely on housing, because I wanted to talk about another story first. Again, front page of the Business Post, and the two of you might have opinions or observations on this one too, but it's absence rates predicted to rise to 30% as businesses urge new close contact rules. I love this stuff again from IBEC, who must be the most self-defeating organization on the planet, constantly arguing for policies that are going to damage their own members. Like, this one, obviously, there's huge. We know yesterday was the record, I believe, 26,000 people infected with COVID. And obviously, with 26,000 people, there's going to be an awful lot of close contacts. We're seeing huge amount of people who can't attend work as a result of being close contacts. And a lot, because it's Omicron, because it's so transmissible, a lot of those close contacts are actually turning out to be confirmed cases. But anyway, in this article, it's talking about, surprisingly talking about manufacturing sector predominantly, but other businesses as well, they're saying, are expected to exceed 30% absences as a result of COVID-19 case numbers and isolation rules. And what they're looking for is an easing off of the close contact rules. Now, you ease off on the close contact rules and you're going to see an increase in actual infections, which means more close contacts and more infections. And I just, especially when you consider the fact that Omicron, people, you can see this constantly on Twitter, people who had Delta only a couple of weeks ago are contracting Omicron. So this is a whole brand new disease as far as your body is concerned. Like, everybody who's had Delta is still able to catch Omicron. So for them to ask to ease up on these rules, I think is self-defeating, because they're just going to see more absences. In fact, what should be happening, but they'll never do this, is IBEC should be contacting their own members and saying, can you please ensure there's enough hand sanitizer? Can you please ensure that there's social distancing? Can you please adhere to the guidelines and advice? Because I know for a fact that many businesses out there, including the sector that's most hit by this, retail, it's not happening. They're not adhering to the rules the way that they did in March and April of 2020. So, yeah, again, going after false gods and pointing the finger of blame in the wrong direction, saying that the reason that businesses are having to operate on reduced hours. And by the way, they're saying, I love the way they manage statistics in some of these stories, but like this stuff of a lot of, what was it? Hold on, let me read out one of them. It says reduced hours in 45% of retailers. Right, is what's happening because 50,000 shop staff have been affected by these rules. Now, I'd imagine most of the close contacts in retail are actually infections, to be perfectly honest, because in the second and third wave, the CSO data shows that the second and third wave of the original virus, the industries that was most impacted was retail. So a lot of these people have the virus, and IBEC are arguing that they shouldn't have to stay at home if they're just a close contact, right? And they should get a PCR test. The irony of a major retailer selling faulty antigen tests while all this is going on isn't lost on me either. But these arguments, 45% of retailers are having to operate on less hours. And when I look at that, I'm going, no, they aren't. But it's carefully worded. 45% of retailers, not retail shops, not retail outlets, but 45% of retailers, because they know corner shops, yeah, they're having to close down early and reduced hours. But Tesco, Dunn Stores, Super Value, and all the Lidl and Aldi, between those guys that I've just mentioned there, 90% of retail trade is done in those outlets, the big five, right? So when they say 45% of retailers are having to close early, they're not actually, they're talking about 10% of the market. And they're talking about 45% of 10% of the market, which is far less than 5% of retailers having to close early. But it's how you use the data. Do you know what I mean? You get this information back and you're portrayed in a certain light so that you can get the rules changed and hope that TDs don't recognize the fact that we're talking shit in this. But anyway, look, IBEC just seem to want to compound and make matters worse around these isolation rules and the COVID pandemic. But sure, what's new? I don't know, Michelle, have you got any other stories or anything you wanted to get into here? Or Connor, do you want to come in now? Have you got anything else there?
Yeah, I mean, like just on that, in the Sunday Business Post, you know, there's a spread on kind of hospitality, which is the other kind of major, you know, kind of sector that's been hit after kind of retail. And it's basically, it's a sector that is not facing up to the reality of its own issues, which is kind of low pay, very bad kind of working conditions, strong bullying, misogynistic culture, especially in like restaurants. Which they just won't tackle or like deal with, you know. And then they're saying we can't get staff and it's because of the PPP payments. He says, no, it's because there are serious structural fundamental issues in your sector. And again, I think this ties into the insurance kind of story from earlier on, because where I would agree with kind of hospitality, more kind of hospitality than retail, but where hospitality has a case is not what's being put forward here in the Business Post. Where they have a case is in high insurance costs, high rents, and these are not being tackled because these are protected sectors by the state. Landlords and insurance companies are protected in terms of law and of kind of state policy. So if these are protected, where's your room for squeezing for kind of making kind of savings? It's in wages,
yeah,
and it's in staff, and that's what's happening here. But when you do that, then you can't hang on to staff or you lose them. So like one of their solutions that is being put forward is to have more work visas because we can't get the staff. So again, just outsourcing their problems, you know,
yeah.
That will not tackle the serious kind of fundamental issues that are in the sector. Some of which is on the shoulders of the employers. Some of which is to do with the very toxic kind of culture that's in kind of hospitality. Like there's one job here which they kind of highlight about, you know, it's a salary of kind of 62 grand. It's for a chef, and it's 62 grand plus 300 a week in tips. so is that guaranteed? Is the 300 a week in tips kind of guaranteed? Are people tipping the chef or are they tipping the staff on the floor? And then the chef gets his kind of cuff then from that. So tips have been used, something that mandate that and Sinn Féin and Anakin Knight have been really kind of work and SIPTU have been really, really pushing about trying to change this toxic kind of culture from a legislative perspective.
Hmm.
So that was SIPTU and Unite and Sinn Féin really kind of pushing that, and it's been held up time and time and time again. So there's an issue there, but the issues that aren't being talked about in the Consumer Business Post are high insurance costs, high liability costs, and then extortionate rents.
Mm.
So if you're going to have lower kind of wages, then you need to kind of tackle kind of these things then as well.
Yeah, it's an interesting industry and a very bony one from the guys at the top. But yeah, you're right. There's something to be said around some of that stuff, the rates, the insurance, the lot of that stuff, the protected industries. But just out of interest, 300 quid a week is what you said in tips?
300 a week in tips, in its efforts. This was Shea Max, the long established French bistro located in the shadow of Dublin Castle is offering a salary of 62 grand plus 300 a week in tips in its efforts to recruit a new head chef.
Oh my God, that is some amount
and
of
the
money.
Average and the average kind of salary for head chefs across the country is just under 45,000, according to Indeed.com. So yeah, 60 grand for Shay Max, which I've walked by, but I never realized it was that much of a, it would have kind of that much of a turnover.
They're very generous customers too.
300 a week in like tips, yeah.
For one member of staff, like just one chef. Do you know what I mean?
That's, oh yeah, of course. Yeah. So you're talking.
Multiply that by whatever amount of staff they have, probably 30, yeah. 40 staff in there. And depending on how tips are distributed, like, yeah. You know, sometimes frontline staff the staff on the front get like 50% and then the other staff share out the 50% and all the rest of it. But 300 quid a week is nearly minimum wage. Yeah. Actually, you're getting a minimum wage worker's wage in tips each.
Yeah. In the shadow of like Dublin Castle, there's a metaphor in there somewhere.
Yeah. Interesting. Michelle, you're back with us. Have you got any stories there?
Yeah, I was having a look on something completely different around the data centers. So there's a story here.
Data centers!
Like, yay! I feel like this has turned into a bit of a circus now when it comes to AirGrid and the words moratorium and data centers. It's like, it was this untouchable word because it was so politicized when all the bills were going through and they were being rejected.
Walter White and it's Walter White and like Gus Fring, isn't it? Like, you know, kind of batting it out here,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah. Win. It's like watching it in real time. It's like a soap coming back to it every week. Like, what's going to happen next? It's the next going to be the next turn.
So, I want Danny Dyer, you know, as the data centers.
Yeah,
well, fucking liability. Fuck you.
From their own live episode at the data center conference, which I actually attended, you had the CEO of AirGrid talking about how absolutely doesn't support a moratorium. At this stage, the word was so politicized. He was talking to industry and he was saying, you know, I'm on your side, guys. And then literally just before Christmas, then, you know, there was news that there was going to be they weren't going to be able to facilitate any more connection requests for data centers. So the word moratorium wasn't used because that had become so politicized at this point that they were like, but it got the attention of the industry, and you had the head of the IDA then saying, no, I was assured that data centers were still happening and that you did support data centers and that it would be assessed on a case-by-case basis. But now we're coming back again to say that AirGrid has now told the Business Post again that no, there is going to be no new applications for data centers in Dublin until like post like 2028. So it is actually a moratorium, but everyone's afraid to say it because God forbid someone will say, I told you so, or we were right or whatever. But it's got to the point now where it's now taken months of back and forth between like the government, the IDA and AirGrid deciding whether or not they can ban data centres or not in the Dublin area in particular. But it just seems like it was a big old delay, charade and all of that. But yeah, so basically it's going to be banned until 2028. So it's very interesting. Basically, AirGrid have said they went back and they actually looked at their data and it was actually more than double of the volume expected on the demand side of things that AirGrid had like integrated into their own high demand scenarios for 2030. So basically, they were operating off information that wasn't the reality of what was being reflected. So like that they had so many data centers applications that it actually exceeded anything that they had predicted, even in a high worst case scenario. So yeah, we're doubling down on the ban on new data centers. So it looks like the campaigners have won on that in the Dublin region anyway. And I'm sure we'll see another updated saga, maybe from another lobby group, maybe cloud infrastructure. One of them will come back with a response saying, no, you promised us that you would allow us. It just seems like a lot of conversations with their mates saying, you told me, we pinky promised, lads, come on. Yeah, you can't go back on that now.
Yeah, all hail the new god of Air Grid, who can do this on their own without any political support. Like the Air Grid, I was reading that story as well. Air Grid are doing the job that the government should have been doing, saying that we don't have the capacity to open up more and more data centers around the Dublin region. And Air Grid are doing the sensible thing and saying, and it's not ideological, it's just the sensible thing and saying, we don't want to have to shut down. Like, we don't want to have blackouts, so we won't be able to connect more and more without, you know, some sort of investment in energy in the area. So it's an interesting one again, but we do seem to be coming back to it over and over again. I don't know, Connor, have you any observations on that, or do you want to move on to housing? We were talking about bringing something up around that.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, on kind of data centers, I mean, like, you know, as you know, as like Michelle kind of said there, you know, it's a ban on brand new ones being built, but any that have kind of broken ground or have or haven't kind of given the okay by Air Grid, they were still going to come online. So there still would be kind of new ones there. Hey, what's interesting is that it's a quote from an unnamed source. Certain industry sources have said that locating outside of Dublin is not a viable option for them. And I think that's an interesting point, because you'll hear, like, there's a real, I'm doing some work at the moment on the County Clare, just for Acorn Report. And there's a real push for a data center in Ennis, you know. And they keep on making some outrageous kind of claims in terms of the jobs that we made from it, and just the, and you know how, like, there was one line about, you know, how you know if they built this like data center in Ennis, it would bring companies that use kind of data, that if they use data, they would then locate to Ennis, not quite understanding how the internet works, I think. How once you have a cable, you can have your data center in Ennis and the data in like California, which is what will happen. Yeah. It's a cable. It's like that line from Zoolander, you know, the data is in the computer. You know, have you seen the film?
I've seen it. I don't remember that bit.
Oh, it's a brilliant line where you go, the data, it's in the computer. It's in the computer. So you start smashing open the computer in order to find the data that's in it. Like, this is all internet, yeah. You know? So, yeah. But what's interesting is that the data center industry is being used as if it's a new FDI and county councils. Instead of actually coming up with, I think anyway, instead of coming up with viable 5-year, 10-year plans for counties, are kind of drinking the kind of Kool-Aid and saying that like data centers will save us, as if kind of data centers are the same kind of technology as, let's say, the kind of motor car was in like 1920 in like Detroit. You know, Kuwait, it's not the same. You know, because, you know, they're looking at all.
Can I ask you a question on that one, right? What do you think it is that's leading to these county managers and senior people in the councils thinking that it's going to bring in jobs when everywhere says that the average data center employs 20 people?
Well, you know, it's obviously, like, I don't know whether it's a new year and I've caught some kind of nuance bug. But I actually feel that, you know, that like that four kind of county and like city managers, most of them are coming from, you know, a very strong kind of right wing kind of, you know, capitalistic way of like thinking. But their hands are still tied in terms of like central funding. So they have to kind of make do in terms of plans for the future. When you look at counties like Clare, the problem goes back to the national kind of development plan, where there are which lays out that there are five core cities in the south, and that's it. So it's Dublin, Waterford, Cork, Limerick, and and Galway. And these are the new centres of gravity. And everywhere else has to kind of make do outside of these centres of the gravity. Even for Clare, the only part of the county Clare that ends up in the National Development Plan is the Shannon Hub area, which is linked to kind of Limerick, you know. So it's all about bringing jobs to these kind of cities or like these areas, and then not having money for the infrastructure that's needed to have viable kind of counties outside of these kind of five kind of hub areas and their catchment areas. So there's real problems in that the ideology in the state, it's in the machine itself, it's in the plans, it's in these 5-year, 10-year plans, which don't change when kind of governments change, you know? I mean, they're still going to carry on. So these things have to be tackled. And then you have kind of city managers and the county managers who are unelected and have all, and there's all these kind of issues there. But nevertheless, are trying to do a job when they don't have the tools for that job. And that's policy, is not to give them kind of those tools. You know?
Yeah.
That's kind of gone off board on the whole kind of like data center thing. But the point about kind of data centers is that it's seen as a new kind of gold rush. And that line, it was used by an economist in Clare, that this is a new kind of gold mine, this new kind of gold rush for us. There'll be thousands of jobs. There won't. There'll be like 30 jobs in the kind of data center, and around 200 jobs in like construction. They say that there'll be over 1,000 jobs, but what they've done is something which they do with most of these kind of projects.
It kind of reminds me of the Don't Look Up film. You know, has anyone seen that? Everyone's talking about it at the moment, where they're like, there's going to be loads of jobs and this asteroid comes to Earth. And asteroid's going to take everyone out. But sorry for interrupting. But...
Yeah, I tried watching that and it was interesting seeing kind of, you know, kind of Leonardo, the kind of DiCaprio, obviously bored, you know, just like walking around. He's, you know, anyway. But on the things that, like, you know, that, like, they say that there'll be kind of 200 or kind of 1,000 jobs in this kind of new kind of data center. And I know that I'm losing people even if I'm with this. But what they do is that there are 200 jobs in it, but how they calculate jobs is on a year one basis. So they pretend that the jobs only last for 1 year. So there's 200 jobs, 200 people are needed to build a kind of data center. That's 200 people working for 5 years. How they calculate it is like pretending that those jobs only last for 1 year, and then there's another 200 people, and then another 200 people. So they take 200 jobs and they multiply it by five, and they come up with 1,000 jobs, when really it's 200 jobs over 5 years. It's
How is that even allowed? How is that possible?
Because this gets into the whole kind of, you know, how the ideology is in the stats themselves. Wow. We've lost about 20 subscribers just in the last kind of 10 minutes. I just know we have, because who the hell just hear about kind of Clare.
Just on that, like, Tesco have employed approximately 300,000 people in Ireland over the last 30 years.
Using those stats based on the year one project kind of thing. So, you know, when they calculate something, it's based on full-time equivalent jobs for 1 year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mad. Those 200 jobs. But it's project lasts for 5 years. Oh, well, we'll just pretend.
That's fucking the fight. Yeah. One of the stories I spotted at the Business Post there is, you know, when you read a story and you go, I can see an impending crisis over the hill there. I know this is maybe three to four years down the line that you can, but you're going to be reading a headline in 4 or 5 years saying, childcare emergency as no facilities in place in new housing development. Yeah. But there's an article there saying developers get go ahead not to include creches in apartment schemes. And it's the story is Business Post did an analysis. And 1/3 of all of these large housing developments are being given the go ahead without having to provide any facility. So for every 75 homes built legally, you're supposed to provide 20 childcare places. Now, at the moment, the childcare industry across the country is at breaking point. There's not enough of them. There's just massive waiting lists. My own one that my child is in has over a year of waiting list to get in. And they're now providing these schemes, allowing these schemes to go ahead without any childcare facility. So you can just see it in 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years' time, people moving into these housing estates, not being told, by the way, that there's no childcare facilities for when they do have kids, having to travel. And this again, it links into the whole climate crisis and all the rest of it is, you know, you'll end up having to drive 20 minutes every morning to drop your kid to a facility because they didn't provide for one here. And the argument that they have is that, oh, these new places that we're building, there won't be families moving into them. These are going to be for individuals. Again, ignoring the crisis that families can't afford now to move into to three bedroom semi-detached houses. They're having to move into apartments to get them off lists and everything else. So it's just one of those frustrating ones. You know you're going to be coming back to if the podcast, God willing, is alive in 3 or 4 years' time. I'll review this one again. But Michelle,
they're not even pretending that they're trying to create communities here anymore. They're not even pretending that this is going to be a livable city. They're just literally cutting out the social needs for profit, like, and the state are allowing it. It's bizarre. Is it the same way, like, oh yeah, you know, they say, oh, these apartments aren't meant for families. Is it in the same way that all those student apartments that they built were only meant for students and now they're off the student market and now have families in them, and they got to build those apartments with, you know, smaller space, less windows, less safety measures, all of that. And it's the same thing all over again. I will build these apartments, but they won't be for families. They'll be for these single people, and, you know, the families definitely won't use them. But you're like, they've shown time and time again that they're like listening to the developer lobbyists on this is not where we should be dictating how we build our cities. And it's interesting enough, like, where literally the childhood services Ireland, the IBEC lobby group is actually coming out and saying IBEC is coming up out and against the developers on this, saying like there's literally a shortage. There's 12 months waiting for kids, and like, yeah, and they also use this language as well. Oh, it's only going to be viable if we don't have the creches. This building is only going to be viable. It's only going to be viable if, you know, they're all built up by or bought up by investor funds. It's only going to be viable if the government laid the ground for the build. You know, it's only going to be viable if you have like 4 bunk beds in every room. You know, like, where does it's only going to be viable actually stop when it comes to where developers are going to push this out to? Like, you know, we're just literally taking everything that they say for granted as to, you know, well, we can only build if you literally cut all safety measures. Like, at this point, like, you know, where does that stop? Like, because there doesn't seem to be anyone pushing back on this. Like, this is on board Panala are like, yeah, actually, we're just going to dismiss the fact that you're supposed to have creches in all of these builds over a certain amount. Like, where does that actually stop? Like, developers say something and everyone else goes, they just all jump and say, yeah, whatever you want, take it away.
It's only going to be viable if the state bills and pays for everything and we run off with the profits. That's the way it works.
But it's only going to be viable. And there's a piece in the pullout, the Business Plus, where it's talking about how Glenveagh, one of these big developers who are involved in lots of this, have reported a strong year despite lockdowns. So they've had a 64% increase in their sales. So they've gone from 232 million profit in 2020 to 476 million in 2021.
Not like, bad.
Not viable though. Not viable, guys. Definitely not making a profit on this. Like, I'm sick of it. Like, it's a real life. Like,
Connor, I think you wanted to come in with a housing story, did you? Or was it the NAMA story?
Yeah, like, it's a story that's next to the Glenveagh one, and it's a NAMA has profits again this year. And it's less about kind of NAMA and like going over kind of the whole story, and more about, you know, how this ties into housing, how it ties into kind of insurance, how it ties into home care, and you know, how it ties into creches as well. NAMA said in its year end kind of review that it has to date, and this is from being set up in 2009. It has provided 2,687 houses for social housing to local authorities and approved housing bodies. NAMA had 10,000 housing units built on its books back in like 2010. So that's around 27% of its housing stock went to social housing, and 73% of it went to took on private sector for kind of private gain. And that does not take into the money which like NAMA they provided for new builds for REITs. When REITs kind of came in, and NAMA was the main, it was one of the main kind of lobbyists for bringing REITs like into Ireland. They provided hundreds of millions, billions in funding, startup funding for REITs. It's hard to see how REITs could have taken off, like in Ireland, were enough of the billions that NAMA loaned these companies back in 2014, 2015, like 2016, as well as giving them over large swathes of land, unfinished kind of housing estates, all these other things, and to build kind of new kind of housing units, you know, which were for private gain, as well as NAMA sitting on empty properties, which you saw then last year, until there was a private kind of buyer there for them. The reason why I focus in on that story is not just to kind of spend like 5 minutes kind of, you know, kind of giving about NAMA, which is always a good thing, but like it's about that. I said this kind of earlier on, and just off air, and you were kind of slagging me there, Dave. But like, but the past is never the past. That we're still living in the 2008 crash, and the reason why I say that is that you know this is why I think having a kind of Marxist kind of view of our kind of capital works and is of benefit. How I see these last kind of 10, 15 years is that I see that there was a shift. There was a kind of developer, indigenous kind of a developer, investment class, very small, just at most 200 people, that was more or less kind of wiped out after 2008. Some made it through, but a lot of them, it were kind of wiped out. And what the state did was that, that was like housing construction. It was one of the few non-compador, you know, kind of a capitalist class kind of activities in Ireland. When that class was kind of wiped out, more or less kind of wiped out, or that kind of generation, it was kind of wiped out. The state stepped in and brought its kind of compador kind of ideology to housing, and that meant FDI. So what it did was that it gave everything. It gave tax breaks, it gave grants, it gave funding, billions in funding, to bring over foreign investors into kind of social housing and into housing. And they injected that whole kind of middleman compador way of doing kind of capitalism into housing, which hadn't been there before. So that's what's kind of new kind of today. So we were talking kind of before the show, and like you were asking, well, where has that class gone now? Well, for the most part, I think where they have kind of moved into is into the care kind of industry. So where they see their kind of investment strategies now is in home care, it's in kind of creches, it's in health, it's in these kind of areas, it's in kind of nursing homes. So that ties into COVID-19, and that ties into the HSC, and that ties into the health kind of strategy. The reason why we have only the smallest of increases in the ICU beds in the last kind of 2 years is down to the fact that if the state invests properly in the infrastructure of our health system, where's the room for these private kind of investors then? You will squeeze them out. They've been squeezed out of housing kind of more or less. And when I say kind of more or less, I'm talking about at the top. There are still kind of small kind of developers, like, you know, small kind of Irish kind of housing kind of developers. And those guys who, you know, who are involved in the site in the Coolock, they're all Irish. But they're not setting a policy now. So where they've moved into in this class is into those areas that need huge state investment for living with COVID. And the resistance to that from the HSE and from NPHET just over the last 2 years is to hold the line. We have to hold the line in non-investment. We need scarcity in the health system in order to have waiting lists, because waiting lists is our profit strategy. And if we tackle that, then we've lost housing and we've lost health then as well. And we can't do it. It's all kind of ties in here, you know? And I think that that's one of the benefits of having a kind of Marxist kind of analysis of Lagrange capital. So fuck yous all. That's the way forward.
And it's a good word to use, legacy, because like thinking about what you've just said there, there's a this whole thing of never let a good crisis go to waste. That's what happened 12, 13 years ago. You know, we had the shock, the economic shock, and they used it to their advantage with through NAMA.
Well, yeah, well, but I'd see less as seen the, you know, less as them kind of using it to their kind of advantage, as to using their kind of ideology to shape the future still.
Mm.
That didn't change. So they were in panic stage. They did panic. They were under kind of pressure. But how they kind of responded to it was still in a kind of Irish kind of capital capitalist way of like thinking. Mm. And it moved into an area of Irish kind of capitalism where it hadn't been kind of before. You know? Right.
Yeah.
And we're kind of dealing with this kind of here and now. And I think that's where kind of it is a missing piece in the analysis. I think that's where it is, because it's more than just saying there's more to kind of Irish capitalism than Dennis O'Brien and Sizer.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, Irish capitalism is Paul Reed. Irish capitalism is Tony Hula.
Yeah.
Their job is to protect the investment strategies that are out there in health. And that's what they're doing. And they're paid $500,000 plus for that.
Yeah.
To hold the line. And that's what they're doing.
Yeah. And the comparison I was going to make there in relation to what happened 12, 13 years ago to this current pandemic is that we now have longer waiting lists than we've ever had before. Like, they, not only have they not addressed what was going on wrong, but because of the pandemic, partly, but also because they're failing to address it. We've over 900,000 people on waiting lists, which we've never gone beyond before. And then that brings me to an article that's in the Business Post. Our kite flying politicians haven't yet given health workers a red cent. This is an article by Tony O'Brien.
Who also fucking carried water for these fuckers for like 5-10 years. Like, you know, I mean, that guy should be in fucking prison. For the way that he defended I better kind of watch my language here for kind of libel reasons, but the whole Grace case, he knew, like, that fucker and Grace.
Mm.
No.
Well, his article there is about how we haven't rewarded healthcare workers for their service over and above the call of duty. But he makes a call on union leaders and everyone else to stop the what about me attitude in relation to this, that these healthcare workers deserve a little once-off payment effectively is what he's looking for. And I'd argue that healthcare workers, along with everyone else, would much prefer investment in the healthcare system to take the pressure off the nurses, the doctors, the whole healthcare system. But this is that whole thing again, pointing over onto in the wrong direction, pointing over to the hill and saying, look at over there. You know, this isn't an issue for the vast majority of people in the healthcare system, a once-off thing. What they deserve is decent pay, decent terms and conditions of employment, the ability to negotiate better pay and all the rest of it, and they're not being given it. But he is making the play that he says there is no practical or moral equivalence to what was endured by those who kept the health and social care service going. So it didn't take long, did it, to forget about the sacrifice that everybody else in the economy is making. And the irony in him saying that we should get rid of the what about me attitude when he's actually trying to play healthcare workers against everybody else. You know, it's completely not lost on me. But what benefits all of us is to take the pressure off healthcare workers to be able to hire enough nurses on decent terms and conditions of employment. So there's no row about this. The healthcare workers aren't having a fight about getting an extra week's pay. Healthcare workers want more nurses in the healthcare system to help out those colleagues who are really suffering and doing 12 and 18 and 24 hour shifts in some occasions. So it's just one of those things again. But again, it's that legacy thing. They're not going to let COVID go without trying to shape. Like, without a strong campaign from the left, for want of a better phrase, but without a strong campaign there, we're going to see more and more waiting lists because that is the business model. That's what they want.
Yeah,
so,
yeah. And, you know, they made it clear since, going back to the 1990s, that's the Hogan business plan. And when you look at the investment in nursing homes and care post 2007, where it is just shot up, that's where you see where has the money gone now. It's now gone into these kind of services. And the last thing they want now is proper investment in those kind of strategies, because where do they then, how do they kind of make a buck then, you know?
Mm. Yeah. Well, look, I'm going to wrap up the podcast unless you have anything else you want to jump in.
Oh, I have one
there.
More. I have, okay, I have, yeah, Richard Grogan.
Oh, yes. Sorry. Go ahead.
There's a whole spread here on That's a Fact Guy.
In what paper? What paper is in it?
It's in the Sunday Business Post. It's how a straight-talking kind of solicitor became a surprise hit on TikTok. And this is about, Richard Grogan, who's been giving advice of sorts online and in like social media on kind of employment law. And I think it is kind of problematic just what he's doing, because however kind of well-meaning it may be, and it does seem to be genuine, I will kind of give him that, it's still coming from a very privileged middle-class view of how the world works. What he's doing is that he's saying, like, he's explaining employment law and the people's rights, you know, in terms of COVID and whether they should go into work or not, and the Health and Safety Act of 2005. But he's trying, his approach, and he seems to believe this, because I do think it is kind of genuine, even if it is kind of misguided, but he seems to believe that the problem in the workplace is an imbalance of legal information, that people are suffering from an imbalance of the proper legal information for their rights. And it's not. The problem in the workplace is that there is a serious imbalance of power. Mm-hmm. And that's the problem. I really genuinely hope there was no 18 or 19 year old out there who followed his advice to march up to the manager and demand kind of their rights all on their own. The one thing people should do is join a union, because the problem is not an imbalance of information, it's an imbalance of power. There's a power imbalance in the workplace, and having some guy who has a TikTok kind of account is not going to address that imbalance of power. The fact that this imbalance of power is non-contentious to show that, in saying that it exists, is that the reason why joining a trade union is a human right is because it is recognized that there is a serious imbalance of power in the workplace. You are not equal to your current employer. They have incredible power over you during your hours of occupation. And no TikTok kind of like account is going to change that. I genuinely hope nobody follows his advice, as he put it, which was to send an email and to march in there and do X, Y, and Z. Terrible advice. Really terrible advice to tell anyone who's working, to say what you need to do is to start a confrontation with your employer on your own with no backup apart from a fucking TikTok kind of tweet. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, one of the things you should have at the start of every one of those videos is the first thing you need to do on this issue is join a union, and then get into the rest of it.
And then you go in. Exactly. First you join a union. Like that's why I think that like it will give him some benefit of the doubt. But even though he said some kind of very dubious things in the past in terms of Black Rock College and how he would always give kind of benefit of the doubt to fellow kind of Black Rock boys, you know. He himself is a fourth generation Black Rock boy, and his son went to kind of Black Rock. So he went to Black Rock. His father went to Black Rock. His great grandfather, his grandfather went, and his great grandfather went. Like it worked out to like ages. I mean, it's going back to the mid 19th century. There has been a Grogan presence in like Black Rock kind of college, you know. So he's going to walk in there with a certain way of like seeing things, which and being treated with, let's say, Lads kind of like ourselves from Coolock and from Swords probably wouldn't get away with, you know, Kawhi, like, you know.
Yeah, well, it reminds me of that argument I had with a journalist a couple of weeks ago. I say journalist, I use it in a very loose term there, where we had issued a statement in relation to retail workers being abused for telling for the whole pandemic stuff, like frustrations and all. But one of the things they were being abused for was telling customers that they should be wearing a mask, which they were being instructed to do by their employer, right? Yeah. And this journalist was saying, well, they deserve the abuse. She literally said they deserve the abuse because they're breaking the law. And I said, well, hold on a second here. They're not breaking the law. Their employers is telling them to do this because retail workers aren't allowed to do it. But anyway, just to get to the point of what I'm trying to say here is she had no idea of what happens in the real world. And I was saying to her, if you're a retail worker and you tell your employer, no, I'm not doing that because it's not a part of the statutory instrument that I ask somebody to wear a mask. That's up to you as the manager of the store, or that's up to the security guard. They're the only two people who can do this. Then next week, you don't get the hours that you're supposed to get. You know, you might be working 40 hours per week. Suddenly that becomes 10 hours per week, or it could be 0 hours per week, depending on the contract that you're on. Or your shifts might be changed. If you have a banded hour contract, you might be working all mornings and now you get all late evenings, so you can't manage your childcare. The point I'm making here is people don't understand the level of power that an employer has. Yeah. It's the level of who controls the allocation of hours. 85% of Dunn's workers say that the allocation of hours is used as a method of control over them. If that's the case, and you go storming into your employer and you say, I want this addressed, and your employer just goes, yeah, that's no problem. Yeah. And that's how they deal with it.
The midnight shift for just next to 4 weeks, like, you know.
Exactly.
Like, I mean, like it was plainly obvious. Like, having seen kind of his videos on Twitter, I'm not on Instagram because I'm just too old for that. But like, you know, having seen his videos, what kind of jumped out at me? And again, like, I must have gotten some kind of nuanced virus because I'm actually being fair now to people. This is so just unlike me. But like, he is being genuine. They couldn't believe that, and he is trying to kind of help people. And he is kind of saying, and he is right, that this is the law. These are facts, right? But it's plainly obvious that he's given advice for actions that he has never undertaken himself. Mm. There's no way in God's earth he's ever walked into an employer as an 18 or like 19-year-old in retail when it's not a summer job. This is your job. This isn't a summer job. This is your fucking job. This is what pays the bills here. Mm. And got that like confrontational. There's no way, right? He's like, it's like, you know, in a, you know, if you're in a kind of WhatsApp kind of group, there's always somebody, and it's usually a bloke, and you'll say, oh, it, you know, this happened to me, X, Y, and Z. And someone always comes in with, what you should do is, and it's the worst fucking advice. What you should do is go in there and, oh, if that was me, I'd tell him to go fuck himself and blah, 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 blah. Like, you know, he's going, no, you wouldn't. Right, because you obviously have never done that, because if you did, you would not be giving me this daft kind of advice in this kind of situation.
I'd love to do a show specifically on some of this stuff, not him per se, right? But understanding the difference, we were talking about it the other day, Connor, the difference between employment law and labor law. One thing that people don't understand in Ireland a lot of the time is that there's the Industrial Relations Act again comes into play here, the 1991. well, you can't go on strike. Workers can't go on strike over individual issues. Now, he's given advice on individual issues. These are your individual rights. Whereas what's really important in the workplace is the collective rights of workers, because that's the way you address these. But this is the way they used to address things. Someone got unfairly dismissed, we all go out on strike, right? That's how it gets dealt with, and employers puts manners on them. We've gone down this road since 1990 of individual rights. He's like, just I'm not arguing. I don't know the laws that he's out there making these things about, but he seems to be correct on a lot of stuff, right? And it's useful to have that knowledge, but it's about how you address the imbalance of power that you've just spoken about, and you do that collectively. And we need to get mindsets away from these individual rights that he's talking about and more back into the whole collective mindset of how we put manners on employers when they step out of line, type of thing.
Well, but I mean, like, just one kind of final point, because I know that it at times is tight, but like what he did say in his kind of first videos was that's a fact and like that's a law. These are guidelines, right? And it's my kind of understanding that guidelines are not enforceable under the law. And he himself now seems to walk back from that. Because I see there that he's put up a post on like LinkedIn where he kind of says, yeah, these guidelines, it's all very confusing as to what can really happen here, blah, blah, blah. They're guidelines. As far as I know, guidelines are not enforced and not enforceable like, by the law, which make it even more kind of worrying that he's giving that kind of advice kind of that way, you know?
Anyway. Yeah. Well, just on that, right? Because it's important if people are listening to this as well. So, one of the things that journalist said to me was, well, if they get victimized, sure, they can go to the labor court, or, you know, they take an unfair dismissal case. Or
as well, yeah.
Right. It takes you 2 years to get there. That's what it'll take, right? People don't realize that you won't have any money for the next 2 years unless you get another job. But also that a lot of cases now, if not all of them, in the labor court and the WRC are being held in public. So are you going to be employable again in the industry that you're working in? When everybody knows that you've taken an unfair dismissal claim because you told your boss that you didn't want to do X, Y, and Z because it was against the law, right? So there's all of these implications that only a trade union can advise you on and needs to be dealt with.
Because this goes back to, this is not about law, this is about power. This is about power. And the reason why you join a union or have a union is that there's a power imbalance in the workplace.
Mm. Yeah.
And Mr. Grogan here has never kind of experienced that. I don't think he has, because if he has, he wouldn't be someone, you know, like if a great grandfather, you know, started off in like Black Rock College, you know, like I'd say that if they come from a certain kind of class composition in Ireland, right? It's not Eden Moore, you know? And like, and you know, which is where I'm from. And like, his dad was a fucking postman, you know? So, I mean, like, That's where I get into. I have a problem with kind of middle class people giving middle class advice to working class jobs, because it doesn't fucking apply, and you will get into worse trouble. It doesn't realize that.
Yeah, it's a good story to end on. Although I did have one that I wanted to raise. Let's see if I can find this one. It was just a short quote of the week.
It'd be grand if I didn't go on that rant about fucking data centers and Claire, you know. So it's all my fault. Anyone who's still kind of hung on, see, now gets to the juicy bits, lads. So
that was
all a test, just to see
how long you can stay.
Yeah.
Look, I'm going to finish up on this one. Novak, it's a quote of the week from Novak Djokovic's dad. Novak is the Spartacus of the new world who won't tolerate injustice, colonialism, and hypocrisy. This is for not being allowed into Melbourne to compete in the Melbourne Open.
Multi-millionaire.
Multi-millionaire, if not billionaire, actually. Yeah. I know he wouldn't be that close, but maybe. But he has had, he obviously been stopped at immigration in Australia, which many people that happens to, but they have a different colour of skin and are treated far worse than him. They're not put into a hotel. They're put onto an island where they're put into a almost concentration camp style thing. But this happens to one white guy who happens to be an internationally renowned tennis player. I'm not a big fan of tennis, so I don't really know much about him, but he's clearly anti-vax. And the world loses its fucking mind. Yeah. And you think, when I lived in Australia, we used to be watching all the stuff that was going on to the people who were fleeing from Afghanistan, risking their lives on boats trying to get over, and how they were treated afterwards. And not the people who were out singing the praises of Djokovic were nowhere to be seen. And that's what disgusts me and why I wanted to end on that one was, you know, let's not lose our minds over some poor fucking multi-millionaire tennis player. Let's start looking at the real victims that of immigration policies around the world. But right, we'll wrap up on that. This has been The Week of Work. I've been Dave Gibney. We lost Michelle Bourne somewhere along the way, in case you thought she was being exceptionally quiet or her internet connection was quite bad. So I want to thank her for joining us earlier on. And I want to thank my co-host Conor McCabe as well. Once again, plug of the Patreon. Please do what you can to support the podcast. We're at patreon.com/leftblock, as we're part of the Left Block project. So Left Block without a K. Thanks again. Talk to you all again soon.